Cool. So as we've been going through Leviticus, we took a long stop at Leviticus 18, sorry. And then we just did Leviticus 19 last time. And Leviticus 19 kind of gives us a big key to the rest of the book. And it's the main passage is quoted a lot in your New Testament. It is love your neighbor as yourself, right? Love your neighbor as yourself. And we talked a little bit about what that means. What does it mean to love your neighbor? What does it mean to love yourself? I'll just give you guys a brief recap. We as Christians, we believe that we are made in the image and likeness of God, right? That doesn't mean that we look like God. It doesn't mean that we have the abilities of God. But what it means is that when God made us in his image and likeness, he made us for a specific purpose to glorify him in everything that we do, right? So if I make a painting of myself, first of all, it means I'm pretty full of myself. But secondly, it means that I'm trying to convey something to you guys, right? I'm trying to convey attributes and qualities of myself to the world. So when God creates us in his image, you see what he's doing, right? He is attempting to convey aspects of his glory to the universe, right? That's why we were placed in dominion over the creation. God says that everything was placed under the feet of man. And he said, be fruitful and multiply, subdue the earth and have dominion over it. Meaning that there was a unique purpose of mankind to bring the glory of God to his creation. We obviously rejected that. And we said we'd rather live for ourselves than for God. But that issue of being made in the image of God really carries this idea of what does it mean to love yourself? In our culture, the idea of loving yourself is a popular one. People are told all the time, you need to love yourself. You need to love yourself. You need to have higher self-esteem. You need to let go of your insecurities, not care so much about what other people think about you. You need to love yourself. Biblically, that's not what love yourself means. Biblically, that's not what love yourself means. Love yourself, from the biblical standpoint, means see yourself as God created you. Okay, see yourself as God created you. We're made in the image and likeness of God, which means that we bear his image. Right? We bear God's image. And so the more we submit our lives to God, the more in line with God that we're going to be. And how does God feel about you? Well, he loves you enough to die for you, correct? So the more you see God and the more you love God and put him first, the more you're going to see yourself in that light. But the important thing is that if you don't love God first, loving yourself is just going to make you arrogant. It's going to make you very proud. It's going to make you very selfish. It's going to make you very arrogant, right? Because if I really believed that, I mean, think about that for a second. If I really believed that, I shouldn't care what other people think. I should only care what I think about myself. How could I ever be corrected? Right? If one of you guys said, Peter, you're wrong. Guess what? I don't care what you think. I love myself. Right? How could I ever be corrected? How could I ever be proven wrong? How could I ever change? How could I ever have compassion on other people because I'm too wrapped up in myself to care about you? I don't want to be dragged down. I love myself, right? The idea of loving yourself only descends logically from the idea of loving God. You guys understand that, right? Okay. If you love God first, then it doesn't put you in the driver's seat. It puts you in a place of humility where you understand the love that you're supposed to have for yourself. And that also means that as I love God, I'll love his image. Right, so I understand I'm made in the image and likeness of God, but guess who else is? Everybody else, right? So it will cause me to love my neighbor. I'll realize that everyone's my neighbor. Why? Because we all bear that image of God. Are you guys kind of grabbing that? Now, the reason why I went over that is because that is very key to understanding this issue of abortion. Now, I'm going to read you part of Leviticus 20, and I'm going to explain to you why this does tackle the topic of abortion. Okay, Leviticus 20, verse 1 says this. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, again, you shall say to the children of Israel, whoever of the children of Israel or of the strangers who dwell in Israel, who gives any of his descendants to Molech, he shall surely be put to death. The people of the land shall stone him with stones, and I will set my face against that man, and I will cut him off from his people, because he has given some of his descendants to Molech to defile my sanctuary and profane my holy name. And if the people of the land should in any way hide their eyes from the man when he gives some of his descendants to Molech, and they do not kill him, then I will set my face against that man and against his family, and I will cut him off from his people and all who prostitute themselves with him to commit harlotry with Molech. So if you see, this is a very serious command. It's so serious that God is saying, if even his community allows this guy to do that without killing him, I will disown that community, right? That's how serious this command is. Now, when you look at what's being spoken of, right, you have to kind of go back in the history books and figure out what God is talking about. Now, Scott talks about this a lot since he's been over to Israel and he's seen some of these archaeological digs and whatnot. But what we know from archaeology is that in the area that we know today as the Middle East, primarily in the area that we know as Israel, Jordan, that area right there, Yemen, they worshipped a god called Moloch. And this god was a very interesting god. It was a god of fertility and prosperity, right? So meaning if you worshipped him, he was supposed to give you fertility, meaning you ladies, he would make you more fertile, he would allow you to have more children, and he would make your nation more prosperous, and he would help your crops. So he would make you rich, he would make you more benefited, and he would give you a lot of progeny as a result of worshiping him. The key was, the way that you worshiped this god is you had to give your firstborn to him, right? So you take your firstborn, and this god looked like a, I don't know, I've seen pictures of it before, it looks weird. You could Google it if you want, Google like images of Moloch, and they'll show you like excavated images of this god. And he was almost like a cast iron stove looking thing with his arms stretched out like this. And you would place him on a fire and you would superheat him. And then you would take your firstborn child and you would lay him on the arms of Moloch and let him burn alive. Right. So that's how you would worship this god. That's what you would do. Now, the reason why I say this tackles the idea of abortion is because back in the day, the way that the people of Israel justified this was, first of all, they justified it through saying that newborns were not life yet, meaning that life didn't actually begin until you began to give back to your community. Okay, so they had this idea, a very negative idea of children. A lot of them had a very negative idea of children as a whole, and they had a very negative idea, especially of infants. We see that this idea actually carries on even into the New Testament. If you guys probably know the story, and I'm not going to flip to it for you guys, but in Mark chapter 10, people start bringing children to Jesus. And you guys remember, how did the disciples respond to that? Right? They got really upset. You guys see why, right? These kids they're dregs on society. They're not yet contributing back to the community. And so they're kind of looked at as being not very useful. You guys see that? And so they're telling these kids to get away, and Jesus responds by saying, no, 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 unless you become like one of these little children, you can't enter the kingdom, right? And he brings the children to himself. So Jesus kind of bucked against his society, and he said, no, 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 children are valuable because they're made in the image of who? Of God, right? Just because they're of a lower state of development than you, and just because they're at a lower state of a higher state of dependency than you, doesn't change their value in the eyes of God. You guys see that? Now, if you look throughout the Bible, you can see that this theme, this theme of the quality of life and the sanctity of life is woven throughout the Old Testament, but the people's culture superseded the scriptures. Okay, this is what I mean. For all of us, when you come to Christ, you realize that you are coming to a set of scriptures that were given by God, which means that it supersedes every culture and society. But for most of us, when we come to God, we bring our societal predispositions to the Word of God. Okay? So what I mean by that is, what we usually do is we read things in the Bible, and when they agree with what our society tells us and what our culture tells us and what we believe about ourselves, we think that way. But when the Bible says something that goes against our culture and what we think is right, we disagree with it and we have issues with it. And I'm hoping you guys are seeing throughout the book of Leviticus, there's a lot of that, isn't there? Right? When we talk about what is our society view of sex before marriage, what's the view of the Bible's view of sex before marriage, what's the view, right? And you could go through your sexuality, and you could go through your family, and you could go through how the society should function and everything. There are some things that we read and we're like, right on, we like that. But there are certain things in the Bible that we're like, we don't like that because it goes against our society. This is one of these things that are going to go against our society. It just will. Okay. As you can see from the way I told you guys, the way I talked to you guys, not much has changed since the biblical time. Okay, everybody agrees in Jesus' time and in our time, and even in this time, murder was wrong. Right? When the Bible said, thou shalt not murder in the book of Exodus, I hope you guys realize that that wasn't rocket science. That nobody read that and they were like, what? like, I can't just murder people. Like, I can't just kill people. I can't believe God would ask me to do that. No, no, no. That was like totally normal for everybody. When they read that, they're like, of course, you're not supposed to murder people. Duh. What the challenging thing was, is the Bible then brought into focus what constitutes a person. That was what challenged people. And that's what's going to challenge all of us. What constitutes a person? As someone who's a veteran, I feel like I could speak into this with a little bit of insight that you guys might lack. When I was training to go over to Afghanistan, you have to realize I was in the infantry. And so because of that, I was in a position where I would probably have to kill people. That was just the way it was. And the question that a lot of militaries and countries have struggled with throughout time is, how do you take somebody, give them a gun, tell them go out and kill people, and then bring them back into society and make sure that person doesn't become a psychopath, right? Doesn't become a serial killer, people who just kill for fun. Right? How do you do that? This is the solution that every country has come to since the dawn of time. You convince your soldiers that they're not actually fighting people, right? You convince them that they're not actually fighting people. If you can convince them of that, then they would think in their heads, like, yes, I'm doing these horrible atrocities to these people over in Afghanistan, but they're not really people. They're not like you and me. You know, they're not exactly equal with us. So it's okay to do that. That's why when you read throughout history, any of you guys take history classes, you could be like, how could people go into, you read what militaries used to do when they conquered a city, how they would rape women, how they would sell children into slavery, how they would take infants and literally crush their skulls against the ground, right? When you read stuff like that, how could you be like, okay, how could people like this act that way, right? It's just too monstrous for us to think of it. The reason why they're able to act that way is because they didn't see those individuals that they were fighting as people. You guys get that? They were taught that they were superior to them. The greatest example I could give you guys of this would be the Nazis. Okay, the Nazis did what everybody else did before them. They just took it to an extreme. The Nazis believed that they were the superior race. They believed that everybody else was inferior. They didn't think that they were actually human. That's why they were able to lock them in gas chambers. That's why they were able to kill them the way that they did with the utter brutality that they operated in. They really believed that they were superior in everything that they did. You guys understand that? So here's a question. How did the people back in Israel kill their children and not feel bad about it? They didn't see them as people. You guys get that? They hadn't reached the age of development to consider them people. So they were able to square it in their mind. The same thing has happened in our society today. I mean, if you were to ask the average woman or person who has had an abortion or is thinking about having an abortion, and you were to ask them, do you think that killing people is wrong? I very much doubt any of them are going to say, no, I think killing people is totally okay, right? Murderers should be totally legalized in our country. They would never say that. So how do they square abortion in their minds? Do they consider the unborn child a child? No, right? If you guys have ever heard abortion activists speak or talk to someone who's gotten an abortion, who feels okay about it, you'll realize very quickly that they do not consider the unborn child a child. They consider them unborn. They consider them, they call them fetus, which, by the way, I just learned this today. Did you know that fetus is Latin for child? I didn't even know that. So we're just using another, it's like now people are speaking Latin. But the reason why they use that terminology is to justify the fact that it's not really a what? A child, right? So now they speak Latin because of that. And by the way, I did the same thing when I was in the military. We did not call the Afghani people. We called them Hajis. We called them Taliban, right, and some other very crass words. The reason why we did that is because we were trying to convince ourselves that they're not people. You guys get that? That's what we were trying to do. That's what these women are trying to do. They're trying to convince themselves that what they're killing, what they're aborting, is not an actual person. Okay? So what does the Bible say about that, and what do we actually know about that? Okay, well, the Bible says that life, the image of God, is imprinted on you at the point of conception. This is from Psalm 139, verse 13 through 16. For you created my inmost being. You knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you because I am fearfully and wonderfully made. Your works are wonderful. I know that full well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was made in the secret place. When I was woven together in the depths of the earth, your eyes saw my unformed body. All the days ordained for me were written in your book before one of them came to be." So the psalmist seems to think that his existence began in the womb. You guys understand that? So he thinks back to when he was being made in the womb, formed by God, and he says, "I was already a person in the womb." That's how he sees it. You guys following? Okay. Now, what do we know scientifically? Is that true? Is what the psalmist is saying true, or is it metaphor? Well, we know scientifically that, no, he was right. Everything that we've done on embryology has proven that life starts at conception, right? Once the sperm fertilizes the egg in the woman, it becomes its own person. It has its unique set of DNA, and everything that makes you, you, began at the moment of conception, right? The only difference between that zygote and who you are right now is the position that it was in, the level of development it has, and the degree of dependency that it has upon others, right? That's the only difference. But other than that, everything that makes you, you was written, your digital DNA code was written at that moment. You began to be. You guys understand that? That's what we know scientifically. That's what we know physically. To take it one step further, in Ezekiel 16, verse 20 through 22, God is angry at his people because even though he gave them these commandments in Leviticus 20, they didn't keep them. They did not keep these commandments. They would consistently give their children to Moloch. They would sacrifice them in the fire. And there's some pretty horrendous sections of scripture that detail this. In Ezekiel 16, God is angry at them, and he says this: "Moreover, you took your sons and your daughters, whom you bore to me, and these you sacrificed to them to be devoured. Were your acts of harlotry a small matter? That you have slain my children and offered them up by causing them to pass through the fire? And in all your abominations and acts of harlotry, you did not remember the days of your youth, when you were naked and bare, struggling in your blood." Okay, so God is very upset with them, but you notice what he is saying, right? Now, before I get into what God's saying, I think it is important for us as Christians, because I grew up in a home where I always learned that abortion was not okay. But I have to have compassion and understand that most people didn't grow up the way I did, right? Most people did grow up not thinking that way. Most people did grow up learning that life, existence, doesn't begin until you're out of the womb, right? That's how the majority of our culture functions now, okay? And I know that because I spent all day on this site called Shout Your Abortion. How many of you guys have heard of that site? Shout Your Abortion was begun, I think, a couple years ago when this woman named Amanda posted her abortion story on Facebook, and she got some criticism, but she got a lot of praise about women saying, like, "You're so brave, you're so awesome." And so she wrote a book and started a site called Shout Your Abortion, where anyone who's had an abortion could go on that site and post their abortion story, and they could be celebrated and congratulated for what they have done. It was a pretty tough read for me, like going through them and reading through them and just absorbing like what these women were saying. But I do need to point something out, that the primary argument that these women would give is that it was their body. Does that make sense? That it's not right for us as society to put restrictions on what they could do with their own body. Okay. Now notice what God says, though. Is it their body? No. In fact, is it even their kid? No. God's very clearly saying that it's my children. He's saying it's not your body. The issue isn't what a woman can do with her own body. The issue is what you can do to someone else's body. Do you guys get that? That's the whole point of this thou shalt not murder issue. So you can do to your body whatever you want. It may not be beneficial for you. It may hurt you and it may be sinful, but you can do to your body whatever you want. The issue of the law is, can you do to someone else's body whatever you want? And all of us would agree, no. What God is saying is that the reason why he's so pissed off is because those children that they considered to be not human and those children that they considered to be not their own, he's saying they were their own. That is a separate person. They're not only a separate person, but I love them and they're my children, and you took them and did something to them that I am very much opposed to and I'm very upset about. Okay. The statistics on abortion are pretty appalling. Just this year in the United States, I think it was 926,000 abortions took place, right? Now, Joseph Stalin is not anyone's hero, but he had some pretty interesting quotes. Those of you guys who don't know who Joseph Stalin was, he was one of the most horrific dictators in history. In the 50s during the Cold War, he was the dictator of Russia for a lot of it. He killed over 50 million people during his time as dictator over Russia. It's insane how brutal he was. He killed more people in Russia than Hitler ever did in his time as dictator over Germany. So Stalin was actually a worse man than Hitler was, comparatively. Stalin once said, "A single death is a tragedy, whereas millions are simply a statistic." Okay, this is what he's saying. If you kill enough people, the number becomes so big that people lose sight of how important it is. You guys get that? So when I read statistics like that to you, or even when I read them today, they didn't really impact me very much because the number is just so astronomically high, right? It's over, I mean, we're talking worldwide, we're talking 40 million abortions a year, right? That's unbelievable, right? It's unbelievable how high the stats are. In Tucson, there's only like a million people here. If you think about it, just in America, it would be like if the city of Tucson was exterminated, right? That's how many of these unborn children are being killed, right? And it's insane. But what he's saying is that these statistics are so high that you lose sight of how impactful they really are, that these are people that are being killed. And he's right, right? So a lot of times we hear these numbers and they don't really impact us very much because they're just too high. It's too astronomical to even fathom how many people are really being killed, and it's crazy. So God is, once again, he is saying that they are kids, they are children, they do belong to me, and you do not have the right to do to them what you want, right? Beyond that, I love what he says at the end. He says, "And in all your abominations and acts of harlotry, you did not remember the days of your youth when you were naked and bare, struggling in your blood." Now, if you read through Ezekiel 16, the reason why God says this is because in Ezekiel 16, God depicts the children of Israel as being a woman who was abandoned at birth, and she was forsaken and abused, and God comes and saves her, and then later on joins in a marital covenant with her. Okay, so he's saying to them, like, the reason why you're doing these things is because you don't remember the kindness that I showed you when no one else loved you. But that could easily be taken in a different way. Meaning that you could look at this and be like, maybe the reason why it's so easy for us to contemplate the idea of abortion is because we've forgotten the fact that the only reason why we have life now is because someone had mercy on us. Does that make sense? Right? The only reason why I have life is because my parents had mercy on me. They allowed me to live and they raised me. If they wouldn't have done that, then I would be dead, right? Because at that time I was helpless. And so when we callously think about taking the life of unborn children, what we're saying is, well, I'm already alive, so it doesn't really matter what I do to this person who's weak and defenseless. Right? And God is saying the monstrosity of that type of mentality, of like, you have forgotten the fact that you were helpless once and people had mercy on you and you refuse to do the same. There's a show that I like called Once Upon a Time. Last two seasons are garbage, but for the first couple seasons, it was actually pretty okay. You know, it was pretty okay. And I don't know if the writers of the show did this on purpose or not. I don't know enough about their politics to tell you for sure. But it does seem that throughout the show, they have a very anti-abortion message, which is interesting. I don't know enough about them to say for sure if they are anti-abortion, but they do have a very anti-abortion message that's woven throughout the series. The main character was adopted, right? She was adopted out by her parents because the curse was hitting the land and all that stuff. And then when she grew up, she actually had a child and put him up for adoption. And in both instances, the parents, when they're putting their children up for adoption, they say, I want to give you your best chance. And then in comparison to that, later on in the show, there's a woman who's a villain and she has a child and she takes that child and she abandons it in the forest to die. And she looks at the child as it's sitting there helpless, about to die, and she says, I need to give myself my best chance. Right? Now you see the contrast that they're painting there, right? That the two women in the beginning who had their children and who gave them up for adoption, they went through suffering for whose sake? The sake of the child, right? They said, I need to give this child its best chance. It's not about me. It's about what's best for the child. I will suffer so that they might have life. But the villain, she decides to give the child up for whose sake? Her own, right? There was a selfish motive in what she was doing. And again, if you look at the statistics, they're pretty appalling. I'm going to read them to you guys just so you see this. Here are the statistics of why women abort their children, okay? So just think about this. This is a million every year. A million of these happen every year, and these are statistics of why they happen. For the case of rape, right? So that's a big argument from the pro-choice community, right? What if a woman is raped? I'll address that later, but what if a woman is raped? Okay, are you saying that it's not right for her to have an abortion? Well, these are the stats on that. Less than 0.5% of all abortions committed every year have to do with rape, right? So it's a fraction of a percent of it happening. It's almost non-existent. Do you have a question?
So you said
well, I don't know how that translates to the rest of the world. But yeah, but for the United States, so these statistics I'm reading you guys are only for the United States. If you look at other countries like, say, China, I know for a fact that these statistics would change because the vast majority of abortions in China are committed for gender preference, right? So in China, they have an amount of boys and girls that they're allotted, right? They have an amount of children that they're allotted. And in the Chinese culture, men are more valuable than women. So if they have a girl, almost, you know, the vast majority of families would abort that girl, right? They would be just gender preference is the reason. So rape, less than 5%, I mean 0.5%, sorry. Fetal health problems, so that means there's something wrong with the child, and so they abort. Now, these are broad terms, right? So sometimes when it says fetal health problems, it could be the fact that they're saying that the kid was going to die anyway, right? In some circumstance, that could happen, where there's something so wrong with the fetus that it won't make it, and so they abort it because of that. But it also could mean that there is, it's not life-threatening, but the parent just doesn't want to deal with a disabled child, right? So they abort it because of that. That also feeds into this idea of physical health problems, 4%. So together, that's 7% of abortions are done for health reasons. Would interfere with education or career, 4%. They feel like they're not mature enough to raise the child, 7%. 8% of the women did it because they don't want to be a single mother. 19% do it. This like really shocked me. I didn't know this. 19% do it because they're done having children. Right? So that means they already have the amount of children that they want and they just don't want any more, so they abort when they get pregnant again. 23% is because they can't afford a baby. So they're not in a financial spot, they get pregnant, I don't want to have it, bam, aborted. 25% is because they're not ready for a child. So as you guys can see, the vast majority of abortions are done for whose sake? Personal preference, right? I'm preferring myself over my unborn child, right? I want to have a particular life. This child interferes with that life, so I'm going to abort it. So that's kind of just the state of our society right now. And like I said, when I was reading these stories from these women who were shouting their abortions, the vast majority of them were like that. You know, women saying, like, I was in college, I didn't want to drop out. My parents were going to be mad, so I, you know, snuck out, got the abortion without them knowing. I was too young. I didn't want to have the financial burden. I didn't, right? These are the excuses that most women are giving when they have abortions. They're not ready for it. Okay. So let's tackle a different issue. So I think that one of the main reasons why our culture and society has this view towards abortion is because of our perspective of sex and our perspective towards children as a whole. So let's take sex first. Our culture tends to think that sex is a recreational activity that you can do for fun. Biblically, that's not the case. Now, me and Bo took a long time, and I encourage you guys weren't there. You could get the tapes on them on our site. We took a long time explaining the purpose and design for our sexuality. It is to glorify God. But there's another purpose for sex, and it's the obvious one. It's to procreate. Doesn't mean it's the primary purpose. Doesn't mean that every single time you have to that you have sex, you have to be thinking, like, I want to have a child. But it means that is a purpose. It is a function of sex. This is Malachi 2, verse 15. But he did not make them one, having a remnant of the spirit. And why one? He seeks godly offspring. Therefore, take heed to your spirit, and let none deal treacherously with the wife of his youth. So Malachi is saying, why did God take the two and make them one flesh? Because he desires godly offspring, right? He wants them to procreate. He wants them to have children. And he wants them to raise those children to be godly, right? To raise them in a good home and a good household, to understand God and to grow up in a good way, to benefit the society. That's why God brought the two together, made them one. Now, this is so different. It is such a different perspective, and I hope you guys are grabbing this. This is such a different perspective than our society has about sex. Right? Usually if I'm counseling, and I try to say this with as much care and concern as I can, but if I'm counseling two people that are dating, they're having intimacy before marriage, what I usually ask them is I just say, hey, are you ready to have a child? Is that what you guys are ready to do? Are you ready to bring a child into the world? Because that is one of the functions of sex. If you're not ready to bring a child in the world, then you probably shouldn't be having sex. Right? Meaning if you're having sex with someone and you're like, if I get pregnant, my life is over, you probably shouldn't be having sex. Okay, that's not the perspective that God intends for us to bring into our intimacy. It doesn't mean that we shouldn't use planning. Meaning me and my wife have been married for about 3 years now, 3.5 years. We haven't had children yet by choice, right? We have chosen to wait until we're ready. There's nothing wrong with that. The Bible's clear about that. But what is wrong is if we had a mentality where we're selfish and we're just like, gosh, we got pregnant, that ruins our life. It ruins our life and it ruins everything that we want to do. And so we're going to be freaked out. We're going to be anxious and we might even kill that kid to preserve our life, right? That's the wicked mindset that this is talking about, right? If you cannot have a perspective of if we got pregnant, if that was the result of us having sex, that would be beautiful. Why? Because God desires you to have godly offspring. That's one of the reasons why he brought you together, was to have godly offspring. Okay, so our perspective of sex is twisted. It's torqued. We don't have that perspective anymore as a society that like, oh yeah, like sex is supposed to produce offspring. And that leads me into my second point, our perspective of children. For most people in our culture, having kids, whether you're married or not, is considered one of the worst consequences of sex. Right? Whether you're married or not, it's considered one of the worst consequences of sex. We have such a negative view of children in our culture, a massively negative view of children in our culture. Does the Bible have that view? No. Psalm 127, verse 3 through 5, children are a heritage from the Lord. Offspring, a reward from him. Like arrows in the hand of a warrior are children born in one's youth. Blessed is the man, blessed means supremely happy, by the way, is the man whose quiver is full of them. They will not be put to shame when they contend with their opponents in court. Right? I could quote verse after verse after verse after verse for you guys in the Bible, but the long and the short of it is this. God's perspective of having children is that it is one of the best consequences of having intimacy, not one of the worst. The reason why we have a negative view of children is because, and don't take offense to this because I'm in the same camp as you guys, because we're really selfish, right? It's because I'm really selfish. When I think about having children and I think about why I'm afraid of having kids, it all comes down to selfishness. I don't want my life to change. I'm afraid I'm going to be a bad parent, right? I don't want to have the financial burden of having a child. Right, all these things come from my fears and my anxieties, which are all rooted in my selfishness. You guys see that? It's because I'm a selfish man that I don't want to bring in a child into the world. When you have a kid, our culture is absolutely correct. It is a massive sacrifice. It is a massive, massive sacrifice to have a child, to bring one into the world and to raise it. Right? But the Bible turns everything on its head because the Bible says it's better to give than to what? Receive. The Bible says it's better to give, man. It's better to sacrifice than it is to live for yourself. And think about how the gospel totally flies in the face of our culture, doesn't it? Right? In our culture, we're willing to kill for our betterment, but God was willing to die for your betterment. Right? That's the perspective there. That's where the gospel should point us, where it's like, where is love really manifest? Love is manifest most in your death, not in your prosperity. I remember the first time I sat down for marital counseling with Bo. The first thing he said to me was, he said, Peter, marriage is a long, slow death to self. And I was like, man, thanks for that, Bo. That's so encouraging. And he's like, let me explain. Just as Jesus died slowly for his bride and called it joy, So you will have the honor of sharing in your Savior's suffering, and you will die for your wife, and you will count it joy. You've lived your whole life for self, man. You've lived all for you in your singleness. You've made your own decisions just because you're going to make them, and you only think about your own benefit. You're going to have the opportunity to go into a relationship where you can no longer just think about you, where you now have to put someone else's needs above your own, where you have to die. And he says, that is the greatest joy. And I could translate that to having children too. Having children is a long, slow death to self. You're going to have to sacrifice. You're going to have to give things up. You're going to have to make changes to your life. But what the Bible says is that is joy. It's better to give than it is to receive. Now, we just have to ask ourselves this question of, do I really believe that? Me and Bo, it's funny, like when we're in the office together, we'll just randomly say that to each other. Be like, Peter, is it better to give than to receive? Like, I don't know, man. You know, like we'll talk about our marriages. We'll talk about how we're doing. We're very honest with each other. And somebody's going to be like, man, I've really sucked this week, you know, as a husband. And he's like, let me pray for you. You know, do you in this week, have you really believed that it's better to give than to receive? Are you putting your wife's needs above your own? Are you really seeing sacrifice as the key to betterment? Man, are you really walking after Christ and taking up your cross daily? Like, nah, not really, you know, but I should. Children are a benefit from God. Not because they benefit you, but because they require you to die to yourself. And that's the greatest benefit God could give you and me. Right? Now, let's address some of the main objections. So I've given you guys a couple of them, but let's address them really, really vividly in this talk. Some of the main objections to this idea of abortion. Okay, the first one, I already mentioned it, is rape, right? That's one of the primary ones that I've heard from women. What if someone is raped? Now, I've already told you guys that that's the vast, vast, vast minority of cases, but it still happens. It still does happen, and we can't ignore that. It does happen. Women do get pregnant as a result of being raped. And what should we tell the women who are in that situation, right? What should we tell them? Well, the first thing that I want to point out is the Bible's view of rape. The Bible's view of rape. Because this is important. This is something that we need to understand. In our culture, we have kind of a leniency towards rape. It's very odd. You know, it's not that we're lenient in the sense that we excuse it or we think that it's a good thing. But, I mean, if you look at the laws that are on the books for people who commit rape, they're not that severe. What was the penalty in the Bible for rape? It was death, right? It was a death penalty. And I agree with that. I think it should be the death penalty. But listen to the reasoning that is given of why it's the death penalty. Okay, this is Deuteronomy 22, verse 25. If a man finds a betrothed young woman in the countryside, and the man forces her and lies with her, so he rapes her, only the man who lay with her shall die. But you shall do nothing to the young woman. There is in the young woman no sin deserving of death. For just as when a man rises against his neighbor and kills him, even so is this matter. Now listen to that for a second. The Bible compares rape to what? Murder. The Bible compares rape to murder. It says, in the same way that a man comes and murders another man, he says, that's exactly what this is like. It is taking someone's life. It is literally changing their life for the worse, right? It's taking them and it's violating them in such an intimate way that it is compared to murder. Now, the reason why I just want to bring that up is because, again, if we're going to deal with this idea of rape in our culture, I think we have to deal with the fact of how severe do we think it is, right? How serious is it if someone rapes someone else? Well, the Bible thinks it's pretty serious, and I agree with the Bible, right? I should agree with it on everything, but I definitely agree with it on this point, okay, that it is akin to murder. Well, what else? Now, I just wanted to point that out for the reason of understanding what we should do to murderers, to rapists. But I also want to point it out for this perspective. We've already talked about the fact that little children, that unborn children are children. Unborn children are children. Now, it is a tragedy and it is horrible what happened to that woman who was raped. It is horrible what happened to that woman that was raped. But like it or not, that child is a person. It's a person. And it's terrible, that that person had to be conceived in that particular way. It's not good. We shouldn't be happy about it, but they're still there. So let me ask you guys this question. Is a person who's conceived in a way that's horrible, do they deserve to live? Or should we kill them? Meaning, if someone was conceived in a bad way, do we have the right as a society to just kill them? I know most people would say no, right? So if I were to say, okay, let's pretend that there is this person over here, and let's say they're 4 years old, and they were conceived through rape. Do we have the right to just kill them because they were conceived through rape? And almost every way we say no. No, you don't have the right to kill them just because they were conceived through rape. But you see, when it's in the womb, the dialogue changes, doesn't it? Where we're like, when it's in the womb, we're like, yeah, you have the right to kill it because it's in the womb. And what that shows is it shows their agenda, doesn't it? It shows the abortion agenda. And the abortion agenda is what is in the womb is not life. Right? It's not life. If someone was just saying, like, I only agree with abortion in the case of rape, I would have to bring them back to that of like, okay, so why do you disagree with abortion on every other instance? It's because you believe that's life in there, right? So why is the life of someone who's conceived through rape any less valuable as the life of someone who's conceived through legitimate means? To put it another way, are you more valuable, are you more human because you were conceived in the act of a marital intimacy than someone who is conceived in the act of rape, right? And you'd have to kind of wrestle with that idea in your head. Because of that, is it really loving for me to tell that mother, all right, what happened to you is terrible, but here's how we fix it. Kill the life that's in your womb, and it'll make you feel better. Right? Obviously, that's not the solution. Obviously, it's not good for the mother to be a party to killing a person, a human being. That's not a good thing. Once again, if we accept the fact that that is truly life in the womb. Okay, what's another issue? Well, let's talk about the issue of poverty. Let's talk about the issue of poverty. Now, on the site Shout Your Abortion, I'm going to read you some quotes from people who are talking about how awesome this site is. And I want you, these quotes to really sink in because you'll see how people in our society really view movements like this. This is Cecile Richards, president of Planned Parenthood Federation of America. Shout Your Abortion reflects what makes me most hopeful for this next century, that there's a whole new generation of young people who refuse to be judged and shamed about who they are, whether it's their gender identity, their sexual orientation, or what they do to their own body. Okay? So from her perspective, this woman that's writing it, why is Shout Your Abortion, why are movements that are encouraging abortion so good? What's so beneficial about them? Without fear of judgment. That's exactly correct. So she's saying, if we tell people that having an abortion is killing a person, what might we be doing to that person? Judging them and shaming them, which is bad for them. So that's her argument. She's saying, man, if you do that, you're judging that mother who had the abortion, and you're shaming her, and you're making her feel like a murderer. So what's that going to do to her? Again, I feel like I have room to speak on this because I have been a party to people dying. I've never personally killed anyone myself, but I've been in one firefight where two teenagers got killed, and I was a part of that. I've been in mortar missions where we fired mortars over the city and we killed people, meaning that we shot rounds that went into the city and actually killed people. And I've actually shot my weapon into a field. I don't know if it hit anyone or not. I don't know if I killed anyone. I don't think I did, but I might have, right? It's very possible. When I got home, the way that people try to help me deal with that guilt is they told me, Peter, you were in war. It's not your fault, right? You're not responsible for what happened. You were in an impossible situation, and you need to forgive yourself. Now, I'll tell you from personal experience, that doesn't work. Doesn't work. You can tell yourself all you want that you didn't kill someone. You can tell yourself all you want that you didn't do anything wrong, but deep down, you know what you did. Deep down, I know what I did. I know that those were people. I know that I'm responsible. And it doesn't matter how many times people try to tell me that it's okay. It didn't help me. Do you guys get that? It just didn't help me. The only thing that helped me was when I was able to acknowledge what I did and admit that and confess that to God and allow him to forgive me. This is Psalm 32, verse 1 through 5. Blessed is he whose transgression is forgiven, whose sin is covered. Blessed is the man whom the Lord does not impute iniquity, and in whose spirit there is no deceit. When I kept silent, my bones grew old through my groaning all the day long, for day and night your hand was heavy on me. My vitality was turned into the drought of summer. I acknowledged my sin to you, and my iniquity I have not hidden. I said, I will confess my transgressions to the Lord, and you forgave the iniquity of my sin. Dealing with your guilt, and it doesn't matter what guilt you have. You could have guilt and regret over doing something as serious as what I've done, or you could have guilt and regret over doing something less serious, whatever it is. All of us, I'd be willing to bet, if we went around the new room, we all have things that we've done in our life that we severely regret. And at times in our life, we think about those things, and they haunt us to an extent. And the question is, what do you do with that regret? What do you do with that guilt when you feel it? For most of us, we try to shove that guilt down. We try to tell ourselves that it wasn't our fault. But again, I'm speaking from personal experience, that won't work. You could do it over and over and over again. You could tell yourself over and over and over again that it wasn't your fault, that it's not your fault, you're excused from it, doesn't matter. It will haunt you. It will keep coming up. It will keep pestering you for the rest of your life. It will just get stronger and stronger and stronger as time goes on, right? At best, you'll be successful. You will silence your guilt, and you will tell yourself that you did nothing wrong. There's a group of people that don't think that they've done anything wrong. They're called sociopaths. So if you're successful in doing that, if you're successful in dealing with your guilt by telling yourself that it wasn't your fault, you might be successful in every area of your life of guilt. And you're going to become a sociopath. You're going to be someone who's not going to be able to admit to any amount of wrong. The only way that you could deal with wrong in a correct way is by admitting what you did. Going before God and confessing it and saying, God, I blew it. But I know that your son came and died for sinners. You didn't come for people who were good. You didn't come for people who were awesome and all together. You came for people who were broken, wicked, horrible people. And I'm one of them. And I need your grace. I need your forgiveness. And every single time I had that guilt hit me and regret hit me, I had to bring my guilt and regret back to God over and over and over and over again until it finally went away. It took a long time. But it worked. You don't need excuses, you need forgiveness. That's the whole issue. You don't need excuses, you need forgiveness. These women don't need excuses made for them. They need forgiveness. And there's only one place they could get that, and that's with God. So if we really love them, we really care about them, that's where we should point them, not towards telling them that, hey, what you did is not a big deal and it doesn't matter. Okay? What about this idea that, man, if they're born in impoverished zones, it will ruin the life of the mother, or ruin the life of the child? This is a quote from Margaret Sanger, who is one of the founders of Planned Parenthood, actually. Margaret Sanger. She says this, I think the greatest sin in the world is bringing children into the world that have disease from their parents, that have no chance in the world to be a human being practically. Delinquents, prisoners, all sorts of things just marked when they are born. That, to me, is the greatest sin that people can commit. So what she's saying, what's the greatest sin you can commit? Bring a child into the world that is A, mentally deficient, or B, impoverished. Right? If you do that, you're a horrible person. Right? Now, throughout my life, I grew up in a family that, at the time I was born, the time I was growing up, my family was pretty well off, meaning that we were pretty wealthy. Right, so I was able to be in contact with some people that were pretty wealthy, and I myself was pretty wealthy. And I'll tell you this, having wealth, being rich, does not make someone happy. It's not what kids need. I've seen some of the greatest dysfunction occur in families that are wealthy. Right, being wealthy doesn't make someone happy. Being wealthy doesn't make someone a good parent. On the flip side, I've seen children raised in utter poverty, poverty that would make you and I cringe. Because we're in America and we don't understand what it's like to actually be in a civilization situation where most people are starving to death, right? It's horrible. But I saw them raised and they were seemingly pretty happy. We as people, we don't need money. That's not what's wrong with us, right? We need people to be there for us and to love us. If someone thinks that killing their child is the best thing to do for them because they don't want them to grow up impoverished, then they don't understand the first thing about raising children anyway. Being wealthy is not going to make you a good parent. You could be a great parent and be dirt poor. You know, Jesus was poor, right? Jesus was dirt poor. Man, he grew up in Nazareth. He didn't have anything. When the parents came to dedicate him at the temple, they brought an offering that God prescribed for the poorest of the poor, a turtle dove, right? Jesus was dirt poor. And you know what? He had a pretty good home life. Right? Being rich, being poor, that has nothing to do with your parental skills. You could be unbelievably poor and have amazing parents that give you attention and affection and help you to grow and to learn and to develop. On the flip side, you could have parents that are massively wealthy and they could be rotten. They could give you no time of day. They could give you no amount of affection. Right? Money is not the issue. It's our ability and capacity to love. That's the issue. But that being said, adoption's always an option. Okay, there's a site I encourage you guys to go. If this issue hits you and you're like, man, I want to do more. I want to help out. Awesome. Abort73 is a great ministry to go to, board73.com. They're an awesome ministry. They've actually come into our youth group and spoken before. You could see them on our site. Hands of Hope, another amazing ministry. Look them up. End Abortion Now is another incredible ministry. They're out in Phoenix. I encourage you guys to go to them. And they said something to me that just really convicted me. They said something on one of their videos that just really, really convicted me, where they're standing outside of this abortion mill and they actually protest at abortion mills, which is nuts. And someone responded to them and they say, like, well, where are these kids going to go? And they said, we will adopt them. And they were like, no joke. They were dead serious. They're like, they were telling these parents, they're like, this is the plan that we have. If you decide to keep your child and you do not want to have it, there are members in our congregation that have already agreed to adopt children from this outreach. And I was like, man, dude, like, that is like the love of Christ, that they literally have so much love for their neighbor that they're willing to sacrifice for someone they've never even met. And I'm like, gosh, do I have that kind of love? Like, do I have that kind of love in my heart where I would be like, man, I'll adopt your kid. If it means your child not dying, I will take him. I will take him. I mean, that's just a radical, radical thing, and it definitely shines the love of Christ. So yeah, End Abortion Now. Those guys are awesome. They're out in Phoenix out of Apologia Church. Look them up. All right? But adoption is definitely on the table for people who still don't want to have a kid. If they're just like, I'm not ready, or whatever. Okay, adoption is there for you. Okay. I'm going to read a couple sections from these women's testimonies just so you could see exactly what I'm talking about callousness. This is from one woman. She said, abortion is normal, abortion is common, abortion is happening, and above all, abortion is freedom. This is from another woman. My abortion was the first empowering choice that I had made for myself. In a very long time, I was drowning. I believe that my abortion was a major catalyst for me to get my life together. I felt no remorse or guilt, and I have no second thoughts. This is from a different woman. She says, I was on a 4-year scholarship. I wanted to finish with a degree. I knew if my dad found out, he would make me come home and get a job and raise his grandchild. Plus, he'd be very disappointed and ashamed of me. Adoption was not an option for me. My parents didn't believe in it. I had a plan for my life, and being forced to get married and to be a parent wasn't part of my vision. So I decided to terminate. I'm not a religious person, but I am spiritual, and I don't believe that I am any less of a woman for making that choice many moons ago. My abortion was what was best for me. I don't believe I'm going to a place of fire and brimstone, nor do I believe that I should be ashamed. All right. So this is the kind of mentality that, story after story after story that I was reading today. That's the kind of callousness that these women have. And you guys, I hope you see that this callousness is not born out of they're all jerks, right? That's not where it's out of. It's born out of the fact that they've done something that they knew was wrong, and they've convinced themselves that it wasn't, to deal with their guilt. In Romans chapter 1, it says that we suppress the truth in righteousness, meaning that we know that what we're doing is wrong, but we don't want to believe it, to deal with our own guilt. And again, the best thing that we can do for people like this and for ourselves is to realize that what we need is a Savior, right? We don't need more excuses. We need forgiveness, right? And so we should help people understand that and help them with their options. These ministries that I mentioned are great at doing that. They're great at helping these women understand their place. They're great at helping women understand the forgiveness of God, and they're great at helping women understand their options in a much better way. So anyway, that's all I have for you guys tonight. Do you have any questions about abortion? Like I said, kind of heavier topic, but you guys have any questions about it? Yeah.
What was the verse about the
rape-like murder? Deuteronomy 22, verse 25 through 29. I put the whole thing on there because, by the way, this is the exact verse that people use, atheists use. I don't know how many of you guys have heard this before. This is the exact verse that atheists use to say that the Bible approves of rape, which is really interesting. Because the very next verse talks about, I'll just read it to you guys. It says, if a man finds a young woman who is a virgin, so she's not married. The previous verse was about women who are married. Who is a virgin, who is betrothed, and he seizes her and lies with her. And they are found out, then the man who lay with her shall give to the young woman's father 50 shekels of silver, and she shall be his wife because he has humbled her. He shall not be permitted to divorce her all her days. And a lot of people say, see? So in that scenario, the woman is forced to marry her rapist. And obviously, when you read it in context, you're like, that can't be what this verse is saying, because what did the Bible just compare rape to? Murder. So why on earth would the Bible in one section say rape is the same thing as murder, and the next section say if you get raped, then you have to marry your rapist? So clearly we're misreading the verse. Does that make sense? And when you read it in the Hebrew, you realize that there's nothing in the second verse that would denote anything of rape. All it says is that this man has taken her. It probably just means that he's taken her in a violent act. Why is it a violent act? Because he's not considering her. It's a selfish act. He's taking her and he's having sex with her before they're married, simply because they have passion for one another and they don't care about the consequences. Right? Another reason why I believe that that's a false interpretation of it is in Exodus 22, verse 16. You could look it up on your own time. It's very clear that rape isn't in view in that verse, and the punishment is exactly the same. Right? In Exodus 22, verse 16, it is consensual sex happening between two people who are unmarried, and the punishment is exactly the same as in this verse. So that tells me that we're not dealing with rape in this verse. We're dealing with consensual sex between two people who are unmarried, and that's the punishment. Okay? But yeah, it's Deuteronomy 22. Any other questions? Yeah.
So do you think
when a church... So it's a good question. It's a really good question. Because whether we like it or not, as Christians, and this is something that is... some proponents of abortion mention this. There are a lot of miscarriages. There are a lot of miscarriages, and there are a lot of women who will not come to term with their children. And they would say, like, you know, if your God cares so much about abortion, why would he allow this to happen? And the answer is very simple. You know, God, it's simple, but it's still heavy, and still something that we need to meditate on. God has allowed us to live in a fallen world, right? We've chosen to reject him, and that means that death reigns, right? Death reigns for unborn children, and it also reigns for born children, right? Children will die. People will die. That's the kind of world that we live in. And when you look through the Bible, there are certain evidences that children who have not reached a particular age will go straight to heaven. There are certain evidences that might suggest that. One of the most powerful ones is in the book of 2 Samuel. David's son dies. David's son dies who is, he was a toddler at the time. And David says very clearly, he says, he will not come to me, but I will go to him. Meaning that David had a supreme hope that he would go and see his son one day. So obviously David believed that he went right to heaven. What I always tell people is this, though. What I believe is that God has sovereignty over our salvation. God is the one who opens our eyes. God is the one who died for our sins. God is the one who saves us. God has sovereignty over who gets saved and who doesn't. So I believe and I have faith that my Father in heaven will do everything he can to save everyone he can. And so if there are unborn children who are killed, and if there are little children who are killed, I believe that our Father will take care of them, right? I don't know exactly what that means, but I know I trust him to do what's right. And that's kind of where it ends for me, right? So like I said, there's evidences to suggest that they would, but who knows? And by the way, there's a lot of reasons why people reject that idea, that unborn children would go straight to heaven. Because if that's the truth, then maybe the most loving thing for us to do is to what? Abort them. So that they don't go through this life. Man, maybe that's the best thing to do, because heaven is eternal and this life is transient. So maybe the best thing we can do is kill our kids so then they don't go through the suffering of this life. So there's a lot of reasons to reject that mentality and just say, like, no, like, God just has sovereignty over it and we just got to trust him. But yeah, so that's it. One last thing I'll mention, I forgot to say this. Another objection that's given is, what happens if the mother's life is put in danger by the pregnancy? Right? So what if the mother would die if she had birth? Like, are we okay with an abortion then? And the answer is that as Christians, we have to understand that life is sometimes complicated, right? Life is sometimes complicated. It's not always simple. Thomas Aquinas, who was a Christian philosopher, he said there's a law called double effect, meaning that there's an effect that we want that produces an undesired double effect. So for instance, if let's say there was a mugger or some sort of a terrorist or someone like that came in here, and one of the people who does carry weapons had to shoot them, right? The desired effect would be to prevent that person from murdering someone, correct? The undesired effect is that that person dies. Okay, so is it right for them to kill him? Well, yeah, because the desired effect was a good, but it just had an undesired effect that was negative and we didn't want it. Okay, so for the woman who's pregnant and is she would be killed by her pregnancy, it's like, what's the desired effect? To save the mother's life. Does that make sense? The undesired effect would be that the child gets killed. So for instance, if the mother has stage 4 cancer and she has to go through chemotherapy, right? If she goes through chemo, it would kill the child in her womb. But you'd say like, okay, well, if she doesn't get the chemotherapy, they both die, right? So what's the best thing to do? Well, the best thing to do is to allow that child to die for the sake of the mother, right? It's not a great scenario, but it's kind of like what we have to live with in this fallen world, that things like that, decisions like that have to be made. Does that make sense? Cool. Any other questions, or you guys good? Good? Cool. Let me pray, and we'll land for tonight. Father, we thank you for your word, and we know this is a really touchy subject. It's a touchy subject for a lot of people in our culture today, and it's something that is difficult for us to wrestle with. So, Lord, I pray against arrogance for us. Lord, that if we have a mindset and a mentality that we are better than others because we have received your word and we have received your grace, please destroy that heart in us. Help us to have mercy and compassion for those who are going through these circumstances. Lord, help us to lift up and to pray for these women and to ask that you would show them what they're going to do, that in our nation we would make abortion illegal, that these children would be protected. God, we ask for your grace and your mercy in our own lives, that you would forgive us for our own sins, that we might be able to better pursue you. And in your name, amen.